Hello, and welcome back to A Life Economy, dedicated to exploring where technology, spirituality, and consciousness converge to create a more beautiful world. Just when you think the world couldn't get any crazier, it continues to get more and more bizarre. Following the execution of George Floyd and the subsequent riots across the country, the world appears to be in significant turmoil and chaos. And seen from one perspective, that beautiful world has never felt further away. But in another light, you could also view this as a necessary part of healing the trauma from multiple generations of oppression and enslavement of an entire race of people. It has never been clear to me how much I don't understand what it's like to be Black in America, how much of a privilege I have that I live with every day, but don't even see because I have never experienced what it's like to be on the other side. So, where do we go from here? Honestly, I have no idea, but I'm reminded of this quote from Terrence McKenna, and I think it's worth listening to.
It's only going to get weirder. The level of contradiction is going to rise excruciatingly, even beyond the excruciating present levels of contradiction. I think it's just going to get weirder and weirder and weirder, and finally, it's going to be so weird that people are going to have to talk about how weird it is. And at that point, novelty theory can come out of the woods because eventually people are going to say, what the hell is going on? It's just too nuts. It's not enough to say it's nuts. You have to explain why it's so nuts.
So what's fascinating about this interview is that it was recorded in 1998, several decades before everything that is happening currently with the coronavirus and the riots. And what he says in particular about the level of contradiction rising to excruciating levels to the point where people have to have a conversation about it, well, that's exactly what we're seeing right now. What we're seeing playing out in the world, and specifically in America, is we are collectively saying enough is enough. It's time to heal this trauma. I'm going to get off my soapbox here and introduce this episode. We have a really fascinating interview that I did with Andrew Hessel. Andrew is the CEO of Humane Genomics and the co-chair of Bioinformatics and Biotechnology at the Singularity University. We talk about how he's creating technology that is allowing him to engineer viruses and other biological material to cure cancer and solve other illnesses. And I am super grateful for this conversation. Andrew is a super genius. If you're enjoying this podcast, feel free to leave a review on iTunes and make sure to subscribe. Visit alifeeconomy.com for more information. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Andrew Hessel.
You know, one of the most powerful technologies we have today for going in and addressing things like climate change and feeding a growing population and keeping people healthy and repairing some of the ecological damage that we've done over as humans have become so successful is the technology of life. And it's a really interesting challenge to present it because we use natural resources every day to build and operate the world, but it's exploitive and it's unsustainable. Now I'm my training and what I speak about is biotechnology, and how we're learning enough about these living machines based on cells to really start to harness them and use them in a new way to meet the needs of humanity And I think it's really the most powerful technology we have for, you know, for fixing the world. But there's just such a, there's kind of this giant gap between people today and understanding biology and what it's capable of, and a lot of fear around these technologies as we start to use them and apply them. So I try and tell positive stories about where we are, how incredibly economical and sustainable they are, and try and drive home the point that they're coming, whether we're ready or not, because we've just done so much work in the last 50 years in unlocking the secrets of the living cell and learning how to manipulate and even design the metabolic activities of life.
Right. Yeah. So you mentioned synthetic biology, and this is something that we had touched on in a previous episode, but you're really, on the ground, one of the pioneers in this field. Could you talk a little bit about what that means and practically what does it look like in terms of the work that you do?
Yeah. I at the lowest level, I describe synthetic biology as genetic engineering done with digital tools. I guess the end goal of it is to make biology easier to engineer. But I've been in the field for a long time. I started my training in cell biology, which is really learning to look in under the hood at how cells operate. And then I added genetics, which is learning how the operating system of the cell is organized and works. And it's really amazing when you start to do this work because it's just so universal. From the simplest organisms like bacteria to you and me, it's basically the same mechanisms and same programming language. So I've been hooked on this stuff for 25 years. The tools and technologies that make it possible have been growing and expanding and accelerating. And today, the field of synthetic biology is accessible to a lot of people. It's affordable, and it's really starting to prove itself in terms of the real world applications it can deliver. So I end up working to do two things. I'm the co-leader of a community working to make the tools for designing genomes easier, to understand the ethics of this work, to lay down standards and understand intellectual property concerns, and really just try and create a global community for being able to establish best practices. And do communications mm-hmm. around that and celebrate the achievements. And then on a day-to-day basis, I also have a startup company that is working to engineer the smallest genomes. And these are the genomes of viruses. And the tools and technologies for doing that are here now, and I think we have to get good at it. And the applications that we've been building from the outset are designer viruses that can kill cancer cells. And it's just amazing work to be doing. I feel like I'm always inspired. I'm always challenged, and it feels really amazing to be working with leaders of the field.
Yeah. Wow. That's really amazing. So when you talk about creating viruses that can kill cancer, what are some of the benefits of doing it in the way that you're doing it compared to some of the other more classic treatments?
Well, the big take home from the Genome Project, the Human Genome Project, as applied to cancer, was that no two human cancers are the same. essentially their cancer works like an infection, not so different than a bacterial infection, except that in cancer's case, the cells that are growing abnormally in your body and causing problems are mutants of your own cells. And so the challenge is, how do you kill those mutant cells of yours without killing the normal cells of yours? And that is a targeting problem for the most part. And the beautiful thing about using viruses is they are exquisitely good at targeting particular cells. And because we're building these viruses from scratch, like literally programming every base pair of their genetic code, which in turn dictates the virus form and the virus function, we get to build these exquisitely personalized anti-cancer agents, and do it in a short period of time at reasonable cost. So not only can we make these incredible drugs, and I won't call them living drugs because a virus is not really alive. They're more like delivery systems for genetic medicines. But not only can you design these things really quickly, you can really personalize them, and you can do it at extremely low cost. And so it's not only do you get these amazing medicines, but you kind of change the entire process of drug development, because you can make medicines for one patient at a time.
Yeah, super, super fascinating, this notion of creating hyper-personalized medicine. You know, it's something that seems kind of obvious, but doesn't quite exist. And I'm wondering, what are some of the barriers or reasons why this kind of medicine is not more prevalent?
Well, I think it's just because the technology really didn't support it until recently. We're the first FDA-approved personalized therapies were just approved 2 years ago. But that's fantastic. It's not like we have to teach the FDA about making medicines for just one person at a time. They understand that now. And you know, I've worked with the classical biotech industry. It was, at the time, it was only really reasonable to go and make medicines for groups of people. But things have changed. There's been so much technological change in the last 15 or 20 years that this is just one of the really positive, outputs of that change, that we can now realistically make medicines for a single person.
Yeah. And in one of your videos, you had compared the classic process by which pharmaceutical companies produce medicines, comparing it to the way that Hollywood creates blockbusters, whereas now you're looking at more of almost like a Netflix model, where everything on Netflix is, you know, hyper-personalized and recommended to you based on your own interests.
Yeah, it's a little play on words from blockbuster to Netflix, but it's really quite accurate. And I would love to see pharmaceuticals developed for individuals, like, or not just single drugs, but regimens that optimize health and welfare be available as a subscription. And I don't think that's unreasonable as we move forward. It's certainly unfamiliar, but if we just look at the changes that happened in the movie industry and realize the movie industry is not so different than the pharmaceutical industry, I think people will start to understand the possibilities.
Yeah. You know, you were a distinguished researcher at Autodesk, specifically in the life sciences, I guess, what do you call it, the department? of Autodesk?
It was a research group.
It was a research group. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So yeah, the connection there between biotech and movies and CGI is really fascinating with Autodesk. What was it like to work there?
Autodesk is an amazing company. They build really incredible tools for being able to visualize and test and model really complex systems, like buildings, like before they're built. And not only the visualization in particular, I find really fascinating because most people can't hold an idea in their minds unless they can see it. And the beautiful thing about the software tools that Autodesk generated is you could see the things that you were hoping to build, as well as do the complex physics, etc. So it was a really good fit for me in life science. And remember, cells are microscopic, and the machinery that runs the cell is works at the nanoscale. So you really need some sort of visualization software to be able to go into that world. And the physics at that level are pretty strange as well. And just seeing the incredibly complex machines that Autodesk tools allowed to be built, I was so confident that it would be the perfect company to work with to build a platform for visualizing and being able to design living systems.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. And since then, you've gone on to start a company called Humane Genomics. Could you talk a little bit about what that is? And I would love to learn a little bit as well about the name of, you know, specifically the humane part.
Yeah, so when I joined Autodesk, I was pretty clear with them that I really believed that virus genomes were worth pursuing because they were very small genomes, very simple biological machines relative to the living cell. You can, if a cell is like a cell phone, and there are some similarities there. You can think of a virus as really an app that delivers a new function to the cell. So in terms of complexity, working with viruses was really straightforward. So while I was at Autodesk, I started making, these designer viruses, first to following in the footsteps of some classical work to make what's called phage, which are viruses that infect bacteria. Mm-hmm. And from the phage, we went on to make, in collaboration with Auburn University in Alabama, and a company called Gen9 that did DNA synthesis that was since acquired by Ginkgo Bioworks in Boston. We collaborated to make the world's first computer-designed cancer-fighting virus. So we did that at Autodesk. When Autodesk decided to pause their life science efforts, I took that collaboration and we built upon it. We created a company around it, and I called it Humane Genomics, mainly because I'm not good at branding, but also because we are working with dogs as our I really truly believe that it's going to be our companion dogs, the dogs that live in our homes and with us and that we treat like family members, that have the potential to drive and open the doors for personalized treatments and allow us to learn to treat people better in very personalized ways. Yeah, that's kind of how the name arose. And I was incredibly fortunate. Deloitte, a group that I've worked with in the past, the consultancy, just loved the work that we were doing and gave us essentially a startup grant. And it allowed us to organize over the last year and a half. And now we're really Now we're really starting to accelerate. It's getting really exciting.
That's wonderful. And what are some of your goals that you're working towards?
The goals that we're working towards is to be able to work with a single patient, in this case, a dog, be able to get a biopsy of that dog's cancer, and within a clinically relevant time frame, and we're using a month as our starting point, mm-hmm. be able to design, build, and test a virus that will target that dog's cancer and have it work well enough that we can use it clinically.
Right. And I would assume there's some expectation to be able to then graduate towards humans.
Eventually. The knowledge cycle here is incredibly fast because we can actually work with more than one dog at a time because you can stage the various steps in the process: biopsy, analysis, design, construction, testing, in a way that can optimize the process. So, you know, to give you some example, in a very short period of time, you know, say a few months, you could be working on 10 or 20 different projects. Compared to the classical drug industry, these are complete drug development projects, start to finish. No one has ever been able to make, you know, drugs that quickly. So we're learning along the way. We know we're going to start, we're really going to understand this process well, look where the bottlenecks and barriers are, look where the costs are, and ultimately make sure we're putting the foundations together to automate and accelerate the process so that eventually we can scale it. But it's an incredible journey, and all based on our, you know, growing ability to design and build custom genomes.
Yeah. And would love to hear you talk a bit about some of the opportunities for being able to create a genome from scratch. Could it help with the climate crisis and other things like that?
Yeah, I look at, so just sticking with the virus genomes for a minute, it's quite amazing. If there's a cell, every cell on the planet, every bacterium, every plant, every animal has a relationship with a virus. So just, you know, the things that we're going to learn about virology in general over the next decade or two is kind of mind blowing. Like, I think the entire field gets a major upgrade, which is a good thing because viruses, at least in terms of human disease, can be really important. But we don't understand the full relationship of viruses in the natural world. And I think we're going to learn a ton there. But remember, viruses, their main job is just to add code to a cell, plant, animal, or bacterial. So as we master the virus, what we really do is it opens up the possibility of doing rapid changes to any cell on the planet, adding new features, for example, permanent or transient, which allows us to consider, well, how do we make a plant, for example, be more drought resistant or be able to grow in saline conditions that would otherwise kill it, or even improve the photosynthetic process and make it more efficient so it can have longer growth cycles and use less energy, for example. There's so many opportunities that sure. I think, you know, to speculate at this point is kind of overwhelming. But yeah. I absolutely believe that our ability to design and build cells and multicellular systems, what we think of as organisms, will be the most technology we have for creating a new and sustainable balance between humanity and nature.
Mm. Yeah, really, you know, fascinating.
I like to think we're going to move away from exploiting natural resources to working together with nature to create supernatural resources.
Love that. That's beautiful. You mentioned on the Singularity University page bio that you believe that synthetic biology will eventually surpass information technology. Why do you think that? Why is this such a big deal?
Well, when you think about it, information technology is, it's remarkable. We've done, my whole life has been shaped by digital technologies. I'm hooked. but digital technologies, essentially our computers, our screens, our sensors, they're not very smart. They take a look at what a single living cell does. Doesn't matter what type of cell, plant cell. Mm-hmm. It not only has the ability to sense its environment in very complex ways, it has the ability to store gigabits of data in its hard drive, essentially the nucleus. And that cell has the ability to manufacture thousands or tens of thousands of different molecules. And ultimately, that cell has the ability to duplicate itself, to make one, go from one cell to two cells. No human technology today can do that. Computers manipulate bits. Cells sense and manipulate atoms. And it's wild. So I look at computer technology as amazing, and it's changed the world, and it's changing the world, and it's linking us together in new ways, and it's giving us incredible new tools and capabilities. But on top of that, we're starting to learn how to program life, and we can't do it without these digital technologies. But life will surpass anything that our digital technologies will do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
And effortlessly and do it efficiently and sustainably. So I think once you start programming life, there's no going back to programming, slow, dull, dead computers.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. Absolutely. Like nature, the power of nature is something that is one of those unseen forces that we take for granted. It just kind of, everything just works together in this beautiful, harmonious way. And it works so well that it's just kind of in the background, right? But you're someone that, has spent multiple decades immersed in the science and technology and art of understanding how it actually works. How has that affected your perspective of nature and life itself?
Well, and I'm not the most well-read biologist and can recite every molecular pathway and every gene of importance. What I try and do is just never forget that I am made of, I'm a biological machine. And that I am, that my form is the result of 50 trillion or so cells working together to create in concert as a network to build me. And there are so many things happening just to allow me to exist, that it's incomprehensible. Like I don't even have to worry about breathing. So what I try and do more than anything is simply appreciate the life that's around me and how much living things sustain me and the world we live in. So mm-hmm. I can't walk past a wooden table without thanking the tree. I start my car and I realize, you know, I'm still running on banked, you know, right. banked dinosaurs, you know, that we've, yeah. that we've digested and turned into goop that, you know, we can extract the energy from. So I'm so thankful about life. Plus I've worked in the healthcare sector and understand diseases like cancer. So I have a really strong appreciation of when things go wrong. but I also know that it's a universal technology. It's everywhere. And the programming language isn't that hard. And collectively as a species, we've made a foundation now that, you know, as a group that is giving us all the ability to start to use biology as a technology for making the world and humanity better. It's a remarkable time that we're living in right now.
Truly. Agreed. And yeah, I resonate so much with that gratitude for nature, right? Where we can walk outside and be grateful for the air that we breathe and the water and the trees and the sun. And there's, you know, so many little things that, you know, sustain life and keep our whole society going. And to have that, you know, appreciation on more of a scientific level is really cool to hear you talk about. And just on that notion of when you talk about programming life, there's two thoughts or emotions that come up for me simultaneously. This, like, this excitement of seeing this amazing future that you're describing, where it's kind of almost like the Venus Project, where we can, you know, we're working in harmony, we're working in collaboration with nature and in making nature better. And then there's also, you know, it's sort of a double-edged sword, where I can also imagine the sort of Brave New World perspective, where it's like science and nature gone wrong, where we've engineered all the defects and all of the idiosyncrasies out of humanity to the point where it creates this, you know, haves and have-nots class system. What are some of the threats or risks of this technology? Because, you know, some people hear when you describe, like, programming life, or even the phrase synthetic biology, there's some fears that probably come up.
Yeah, very early in the discussions around the field of synthetic biology, a number of people pointed out that it wasn't a great name. but people need to understand, it's not that synthetic biology is synthetic. It's exactly the same biological machinery as in the world around us. The core difference was, we had a machine called a DNA synthesizer that essentially allowed us to take our ideas and turn them into a biological program by writing DNA. It was a DNA synthesizer. So it essentially compiled the program so the cell could run it. You know, again, it's pretty low level engineering stuff at the beginning of any new field. And you're not worried about branding, but the mm-hmm. key technology is the DNA synthesizer. Just as if you're trying to read a genome, your key piece of equipment is a sequencer that reads the genetic code letter by letter. But we always run into this problem where people fear the potential outcomes of people manipulating living systems. What I think needs to be held in perspective is, we've always manipulated living systems for the benefit of humanity. We've either mm-hmm. hunted down animals and eaten them, to started to harness them by growing crops and farming, to selecting the features of various plants and animals that we considered desirable for our foods or decorations or building materials. And biology just, you know, the tools of being able to read and write genomes just makes that, just expands the technology, allows us to be more precise in our manipulations, to be more intentional in our work rather than just use artificial selection, which has been around for as long as humans have been around, where you choose the traits that you want to propagate. Today we can start to think about those traits and build the phenotype, the form of the organism, more by using modeling and simulation techniques that we might use for creating any other device. So I think it's, but that being said, I appreciate that people have fears about things that they don't understand, and most people don't understand biology, and no one understands biology fully because we didn't create the technology. You know, it evolved over billions of years. That's the story scientists say. Some other people believe differently. It doesn't matter to me how it got here. What matters to me is that it is universal, and we have been learning how to use it. And frankly, it's always our kids that stand on our shoulders and start to apply the core technologies. So it'll take a generational change, I'm sure, to really start seeing the benefits in terms of applications for humanity. But I've been doing this for 25 years already, and I've seen the next generation come in and run with this field, just as I came in standing on the shoulders of people in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, 60s that built the computing architectures that I started to use in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So it will take time, but at the end of the day, people will start to see things in their everyday life that are valuable and like are just, they just think, I can't live without this now that I have it. And biology will be delivering more and more of those things as time goes by.
Cool. So it sounds like your perspective on synthetic biology is simply viewing it as an evolution of humanity's relationship with nature.
Absolutely. Like I just tell people, I love life. I just think life is the most beautiful and powerful of all the technologies that we have at our disposal. But it's the only technology we didn't create. Every other technology we created, you know, so this is one where we have to be humble. And we have to have respect and realize we're never going to learn everything because we didn't build it. You know, we may understand 99.99% of what biology can do, but there'll always be mysteries because we didn't build it. It baked in the oven for billions of years, and we don't understand that.
Yeah, is that, as a scientist, is that frustrating to not have that answer? Is that something that you think about often?
No, not at all. It's at the core of why I can be logical and still accept the magical. Life is almost magical because it is so incredibly complex, and yet when you kind of break it down into components and study how the components work, it says, you know, you can see the pathways, you can see the circuits, you can understand the flow of energy. It's, you know, and to be honest, these days, most electronics in the world are magical to me now. I can easily accept that I don't have to understand everything to use it in a good way.
Yeah. And sort of like the miracle of consciousness, right? That we don't have to understand, the ways that all of our neurons fire and, communicate with each other, yet somehow, we're aware of reality.
Or the miracle of the 4K OLED TV that you can buy at Best Buy that allows you to watch the Super Bowl, so incredibly crisply. Like, I have no idea how that technology works. I'm sure someone does.
Absolutely.
But it's not me.
I know. Yes. we've created many incredible technologies, and that point that you make about life being the only one that we didn't create stands out to me as something to think on later. Really fascinating. I would love to learn a little bit about your inspiration for continuing to do this work over several decades. Like, what keeps you going? Why are you so fascinated with all this stuff?
It's just because I've been doing this for most of my life, and I'm just scratching the surface. But the tools and technologies have improved so dramatically over the last 25 years that I'm just thrilled. Like, now it's finally starting to get interesting. And I can feel the energy building and see the acceleration and still know it's early days. Like, I have zero fear of scarcity when it comes to the applications that come out of bioengineering. I also don't buy into the story that there's going to be a giant divide between the haves and have-nots, because the one thing that is kind of the great equalizer in humanity is that we are all alive. Life is pretty inexpensive. And the programming, being able to design and build living machines, and whether that's to make a drug, to heal or to feed us or to create new building materials, or buildings, like probably the idea that resonates the widest in synthetic biology is the idea that one day we just have to plant a seed and in fertile soil, and out of that seed, a house will grow. And like that idea is really powerful. And it speaks to a future where, just because you can't afford to go make something that someone else manufactured, well, we all have access to the self-assembly processes that, underlie all living things. We just have to, assemble the right code. And I should point out that because we have the ability to write code, we're not bounded by species barriers. And I know some people will say, oh, you're making Frankenstein mutants. What it's actually more like is, in my mind, is being able to take the best or the most interesting parts of any creature, plant, animal, microbe, and be able to build combinations that nature couldn't, because nature created a spectrum of living things that speciated. They put firewalls in along the way. But every time you do a little bit of essentially taking code from one organism to another, it creates something magical. So I see this potential to do things that nature could never dream of. And I see that in a positive way, because we're going to be working, we're going to be working with single-celled organisms until we master that process. But it's like, the idea of planting a seed and growing a house for human beings is not out of line, like in terms of the imagination or potentially the creation. But it's early days. You know, I don't want to oversell this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's, you know, we're a long ways away from, you know, such ideas, but they are powerful and exciting. If you could put on your sci-fi cap and imagine where this technology could take us, say in, I don't know, 25 years, what would be included in that vision or that dream in terms of, practical, applications for the average person?
I think there's three areas that are really going to emerge quickly. One of them is food, because food is the biology that touches each and every one of us multiple times a day, like food and drink. And so that's as these technologies get used to their, you know, one of the applications that just has to mushroom is foods, because they're generally considered safe. They're easy enough to test because you can do it yourself and share it with your friends. it's called dinner. and I think that we come together around food and drink. So I think it's something we all understand. I think another one is materials that we use to build the world around us. You know, think of just trees and wood, right? But why do we have to grow a tree if what we want is wood? Especially wood that is, you know, squared or flat, or, you know, like a sheet. Why can't we just take the cells that make a tree and put them into a mold and have wood kind of solidify over a few days and make beams and shapes of all different sizes? I think there's some incredible opportunities there. One of my favorite companies is called Biomason, and they take a bacterial slurry and mix it with sand, and they can make sandstone in just a few days. Like,
That's insane.
Totally amazing. It doesn't use any engineered organisms. It's just taking this bacterial slurry that excretes essentially a glue, and you mix it with sand and it makes sandstone, not in 1,000 years, but in, you know, a few hours. And I just love that type of stuff. So I think in terms of building materials and structural materials and disposable materials that fade away quickly, I think that's going to be a big area. And again, 25 years is not a long period of time, particularly in a highly regulated field. This is why I think food and kind of, you know, these commodity building materials, I think, are going to be kind of lead a lot of the way. And the other one is therapeutics. It's not because I think synthetic biology has the potential to change the drug industry so dramatically that we no longer have to wait 10 or 20 years to get a new drug. I think we'll start to be able to take an individual and create medicines and strategies for them as individuals, and with their approval and their consent and their participation, they start the process pretty much right away, because it's always about balancing the need for treatments versus the risk of a treatment. And there are so many people today that are being they're just being underserviced. They're not getting the things they need to be healthy. So I think that I think we start to see the entire pharmaceutical industry and health industry start to change in the next 25 years. Those are the big ones. And after that, there are so many possible areas, to explore. But it's funny, and I can't explain this. I may have mentioned it to you at Planet Home. But I've also, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. these technologies, life technologies, also allow us to potentially not just, you know, take care of humanity and nature better than ever before. It also gives us the potential to go beyond planet Earth and set up bases on the moon and Mars and beyond, because now we can bring the tools of life that we need to sustain our life with us. So I think this is really, I think synthetic biology is one of the necessary technologies for exploring beyond Earth. And this is a really strange feeling that I've been having more and more, but I also think that it will help us. I think that we can apply these technologies best going into the Earth. And let's put it this way. We're using a tremendous amount of mm-hmm. the Earth's surface for our cities, for our roads, and for growing the food that we need to sustain, you know, 8 billion people. We destroy the rainforest so that we can plant the next cash crop. That doesn't work anymore. The thing that's been welling up inside of me is that we should be moving underground and letting the surface, letting nature, you know, the nature that has evolved to be on the surface of this planet, to let it reset, mm-hmm. to let it heal. Mm-hmm. Because we can go underground easily and make it beautiful, and then come back up to the surface and be in a park, and have dark skies again and see the incredible wonders of the night sky with the naked eye. We can do that with the technologies that we're developing today. It's just so foreign to us. And yet, if we want to go and live on the moon or Mars or in spacecraft, we're going to have to get more comfortable living in enclosed spaces. And it's such a really weird way of thinking about it, because there is absolutely no scarcity of real estate if we go down, nor shortage of energy, nor shortage of water. And the only ecosystems that get disrupted are relatively simple. And certainly in terms of ecologies, most of the life when you go below the surface, go down a mile, it's single-celled organisms. So I can't explain it. I don't have a thesis around it. I haven't written a book around it. But I've just been sensing that it's really important for humanity to start drilling down and exploring how to live well under the surface, to let the surface heal.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to consider the ways in which synthetic biology will allow humans to both travel beyond the Earth and underground as well, right? It's almost like life in a backpack, or life in a box, right?
It's like, I'm a minimalist, and I love the idea of community resources. I love the idea of us all living on a ship. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm just so influenced by Star Trek. Mm-hmm. We really are supported by Spaceship Earth, and we need to take care of it. But right now we're living on the outer hull of the spacecraft.
Right.
Kind of makes sense to go into its belly. But
safer.
I don't know. It's certainly safer. And put it this way: I had the exquisite pleasure of visiting a decommissioned nuclear missile silo a few weeks ago, and you're underground, and there's this incredible, launch tube that once held a thermonuclear missile, or thermonuclear bomb tipped missile, to be accurate, and the energetics of the place was amazing. I had this strong sense that it should be turned into a vertical garden and that we should keep going deeper. But I also slept so well underground. And that facility was designed to survive a close range nuclear explosion, so that, of course, the retaliation was possible. And you realize you're in one of the safest places on the planet. It brought up tremendous feelings in me that I'm still processing, but I'm really going to explore topics like biosecurity at that facility and whether we can actually do things like vertical farming in that facility. We'll see where that goes in the future, I guess, Cosmo.
That's really cool. Yeah, it's funny to think about the future of humanity going into the inner Earth, right? So we have so much of our consciousness is focused around, you know, Mars and potentially other habitable planets and looking for life elsewhere beyond our solar system. But, you know, I really haven't heard too much talk about, you know, what could some of the benefits be if we were to turn our attention more towards the inner Earth.
I've started to do searches in the last few years, what communities do live underground, what structures have been built underground. And it's shockingly few. Mm-hmm. And yet we have robots that can tunnel underneath mountains, and we have robots that can drill down for miles. I think it just needs some exploration. And I think it's one of those things where until you create something that's incredible and inspiring and beautiful, people won't really get it. So, you know, maybe it's just one of those things that, you know, we'll have to partner with a group in the Emirates, you know, where the surface isn't particularly hospitable, you know, to go and build some incredible facility on the ground. I don't know, but, let's just say for me, it's a gut feeling, but those gut feelings, because I'm so future oriented, I pay attention to them. And as I'm speaking with you, I'm in New York City. I'm looking out at, you know, the buildings that we have rising into the sky. And I just think they're beautiful, but what if they went down, you know, miles beneath the surface as well, and turned into giant play, you know, spaces. I guess I first started paying attention to this about a decade ago when in London, the uber rich that have, you know, their mansions were being restricted. They couldn't expand their mansions, and London's a mature city. So they started building down, and the types of facilities that they built underground, were phenomenal. This is not your college basement dorm. You know, these are, you know, garages and spas and tennis courts. And
I want to hang out there.
Well, and so I think we just haven't built, you know, facilities underground using modern technologies where we can control lighting and every wind, you know, we can have all the walls be, you know, retina display screens. You know, we haven't applied our technology to creating super comfortable, you know, spaces that open our hearts underground.
How would that work with?
But the energy, I can tell you, the energy being underground is stunning. Like I'm gonna have to go caving in the next little while. I'm gonna have to go explore underground, you know, communities over the next couple of years. If anyone wants to go and do that work or has some insights, please write to me.
How would we get access to water and sunlight underground?
Water. Remember, where do we get water now? Usually, we drill a well. There's plenty of water underground. Sunlight, we generate, you can do two things. You can use fiber optics to pump natural sunlight down. But in general, our LED lighting is getting extremely good. and is very energy efficient. So being well lit is not a big challenge. And if you really want sunlight, you go up to the surface. Mm-hmm. It's just an elevator ride. And you can have all the sunshine you want without, and nature and trees and everything else. So I think it's just a matter of changing perspectives.
Yeah.
But again, no, this is just off the cuff.
Sure, sure.
But I also believe it's probably underground is probably the best place to, you know, to reassure people that the things that we're doing with synthetic biology aren't going to, you know, contaminate or cause problems with you know, the stuff that nature evolved over billions of years.
Yeah.
Having that isolation, I think, could be important mm-hmm. as well.
And it's cool to think about some of the stuff you were talking about earlier with respect to synthetic biology's use case in terms of food and building materials, leveraging those towards enabling humans to live underground in a more efficient way. One thing that comes to mind specifically with food is potentially the notion of a Star Trek replicator, right? Being able to generate any kind of food automatically. Do you imagine in a world in which synthetic biology is able to create some kind of device like that, where once we're able to fully essentially have the code of a particular food, say an apple or an orange or whatever it is, and then essentially 3D print that?
Well, I'm old fashioned. I don't know how to take matter and assemble it in all the various ways to make a complex thing from base elements. The only thing I know is how that can do that is life. Like, so maybe that replicator is just a garden. Like, right. You know, when you think about life and life processes, it takes elemental materials, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfur, and a few others, and builds the most complex, molecules and machines that we know about. And some of them are delicious. But I don't know of a human technology that can do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would just really like to see the gardens of the future make more than just kale. And sustain humanity in every way that humanity needs to be sustained. And I don't think that's out of reach, because again, the cell, the genetic code, they're just so universal that as we become more proficient and we share our knowledge, I think it just accelerates like crazy. Like no other technology we've built before.
Yeah, well, that's a feature I'm looking forward to. I think you've shared some really, really fascinating information, and I want to thank you for your work and your time. Where can people find you and learn more?
The best way to find me is to connect to the Genome Project, right? This is why I'm back in New York now, after being away for several years, having my children. The Genome Project, right, is a growing community of scientists and engineers and other zealots, I guess, that just want, they're turning their attention to how do you design and build, living machines. And I just think it's the most important work that I'll do in my life. It's still early. You haven't missed anything. It's only been around for a few years. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll be around for thousands of years as we grow the community and tools. You don't have to be a biologist. There's so many vectors into this that, we're all still learning, and it's kind of a blast. But our next meeting is in New York on November 11th to 14th. And if you feel the calling, try and get there. I think it's an important one. This is a transition year. It's actually the Genome Project, right, is combined with a group called that have been working for years to make the first eukaryotic genome, the genome of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or yeast, the foundation of bread and beer. So this is a big step. It's the first complex, the first time a genome of a complex cell, a eukaryote, has been effectively built from scratch. It's been going on for about 8 years now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And everything's accelerating. So that's really where people should, if they're interested in programming biology, that's where they should start. If they're interested in supporting that type of effort, there are plenty of avenues. Come and talk with me. I'll walk you through it. And then really that at the smallest end of the spectrum, working with the viruses, check out Humane Genomics. Again, I just set up a news trawler just for keywords in genomics, and I'm delighted just about every week by the incredible things that pop up in my inbox. The field is moving fast. Another meeting that if people want to learn about the industry, at the beginning of October, there's a meeting in San Francisco called SynBioBeta. It's the industry hub for synthetic biology. And boy, is that a great place to be. It's hopping because I think to date this year, something like $4 billion has flowed into synthetic biology or related startups. So the field is booming. So if you're looking for a career change, if you want to get into a career that will sustain you for a while, may want to check out SynBioBeta.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing. Is there anything else you'd like to let us know about before we wrap it up?
I just want to encourage people not to be afraid of engineered organisms. We are, they sustain us now. And they will continue to sustain us in the future. Personally, I think the biggest existential risk is we don't learn how to cooperate as a species. But humanity, always surprises me. So I believe in life. I love life. I always keep your eyes and ears and senses tuned to life, and think and treat kids well. Kids and animals, and I think you'll find yourself in the right path.
Love it. Well, I love life too. Hopefully you do as well. This has been a really fascinating and amazing conversation, and thank you, Andrew, for sharing your wisdom.
Thank you, Casper. I appreciate it.
That's our show. Thank you so much to Andrew Hessel for this amazing conversation. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, and leave a review on iTunes or visit our website at alifeeconomy.com for more episodes. I hope you have a safe and wonderful rest of your week.